Okay, my name is Bob Cart. I'm founder and chairman of Green Volts, a solar technology company building utility-scale solar power. In my career, I've started several businesses and acquired several and merged and done all of that. Hired hundreds of people and have some ideas, especially on the kind of entrepreneurial bent of what kind of people I've looked for and what kind of skills and knowledge and capabilities.
My name is Ted Shelton. I'm the co-founder and CEO of The Conversation Group. I'm a serial entrepreneur, having founded or joined or helped grow over a dozen companies in my 25 years of working in the technology industry.
I'm Robert Swerling, work for Google. I was a student here, and I was asking myself the same question: how could I become employable? So I did all the things that one did in those days, which was like study hard. I'm not sure that's probably changed. Then I became very employable, went off, became a barrister and was incredibly respectable, and I could hold my head up high at dinner parties, and then I realised I really wasn't that interested in that, and so I became totally unemployable, left the bar with absolutely nowhere to go. All I knew was I wanted to start my own business, which is what I did. So I'm also an entrepreneur. I kind of landed up at Google, so I'm now working for a big company.
Let's see, my name is Reid Hoffman. I'm the co-founder and executive chairman of LinkedIn. I'm a partner at Greylock. I basically kind of found things as an entrepreneur and invest in things, although I did have a couple of jobs way back when.
I'm Jeff Saperstein and have worn many hats. I started in corporate life, managed quite a number of people in budgets, et cetera, and have since that time been a executive and MBA lecturer and teacher. I've authored about 7 books and 3 business case studies, and I work as a consultant. So I have done my own startup, self-employed, and there is a very large market in self-employed people that we can also talk about. But I've worn many hats, and I'm here really as an author, teacher, and consultant.
So would you like to pick up on the question which says, what should students do to be very employable in the future? Why not take your own companies as examples of what you look for?
Actually, I'm going to take it a slightly different direction. I actually think the right way to think of your career as an entrepreneur, whether or not starting a company or not. And I think that the reason is because the old model where you got a job at one place for 30 years is completely gone. It's even gone in Japan. Average 30-year-old has had 4 jobs by the time that they're 30 in Japan, you know, the age of the salaryman. So the question is think of yourself as essentially as a small business, and all of the attributes that apply, brand, competitive position, assets, all the things that would get to kind of analysis of business, analyze your own career. And what you do as an entrepreneur is you think about an iterative plan. It's not like one master plan for 20 years, but you go, okay, I'd kind of like to get here. What are the next couple steps I can do, and how do I maximize a good opportunity on the path of going there? And what intelligence can I bring in, and what assets can I bring to bear in order to get there? And that's the macro framework that you should be thinking about how you go and attack your, you know, think of it as a career. And so the kind of elements that go into that are, for example, there is no risk-free path. There isn't I go become a barrister or anything else, and oh, look, it all works. What you're doing is managing risk intelligently. And part of managing risk intelligently is to think, okay, you know, how much risk can I take? Sometimes you can take a lot because, you know, for example, one of the benefits when I was a student at Oxford, got back from Oxford and decided I wanted to do startups, basically I could, like, you know, live in my dad's apartment, right? And I knew that I had a really, you know, I could go pretty low on the economic thing, and that was, but that's not available for everybody. But how much risk can you take? And then take that as a deployed risk. Another thing that I think about frequently in terms of strategy is always to think in terms of 2 steps. Frequently we say, well, I want to found a company and I don't know how to get to founding a company from here, or I want to work at, you know, a company like Google or a company like, you know, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, any of these things. Okay, what's the 2-step approach of getting there, right? So what's the thing that if I did it, I would have the maximum opportunity of getting that? And that's the same way you think about things as an entrepreneur. It's like, okay, like for example, I want to get financing. Well, all right, what do I have to pull together in order to get financing? Kind of a 2-step. And then use your network for intelligence all the time, for perspective on what you're doing, for getting opportunities, the whole thing. That's kind of the Highline framework that I'd recommend. And
yeah, let me. I want to jump in and add to that. I mean, I think as an employer and also as a company that advises employers. So one of our advisory consultancy practices is to work with the HR departments of large companies around how they are recruiting people into their organizations and how they're enabling them to be more effective in their organizations. And so when you take what Reed's talking about in terms of managing yourself as a brand, managing yourself as an entrepreneur, you look at what the tools are you have available to yourself. And I would encourage you to go and join LinkedIn, Zing if you're in Germany, Twitter, Facebook, all of these tools that allow you to start building a social network. That is one of the assets you have. And I will tell you that one of the things we work with HR departments on is how they, in evaluating candidates, so evaluating whether or not the people that are coming to them are truly employable and do they want to employ them, they look at all those assets that you've created. They look to see if you are in LinkedIn. They look to see how big your network is and how you're using it. Are you getting into these discussion groups and asking and answering questions? Because the people in organizations are more effective if they build their networks and they leverage their own knowledge to help the others in the organization, and they leverage the other people's organizational knowledge to be able to solve the problems they're confronting. So demonstrate explicitly, broadcast that you know how to do that.
And I want to chime in as well. On I think Reed had a great point about thinking about your career as an entrepreneur. It doesn't mean you are an entrepreneur. It doesn't mean you're going to start a business or even join a startup. But think about your own career that way. And so as you're in school studying whatever interests you most, what are you going to do with that? Where are you going to take that? Perhaps you take the same line with as Reed started. Look for a field where you think there's growth, where there's you know may not be your highest interest, but if you go into an area that where there's growth and new demand, you've got more of a likelihood of becoming an expert. So where if you enter a very old and well understood career, you've got many people with much more experience ahead of you, and you've got a harder path, but it's less risk to a certain degree. And so managing that risk and understanding the market for your talent is really important in figuring that out.
Can I ask you, make it sound all very strategic, was your own career path as strategic as that? And Robert, I can see your body language.
Yes, mine was, and I regret it. And I'm going to come at this from a completely different angle. I wouldn't disagree with everything that's been said, but let's put this in context. What do we want in life? You know, we want to lead a happy, fulfilled life. And all of this stuff is just a means to that. And in my experience, and I think there's a lot of evidence now supporting this, through all sorts of studies across the world, is that if that's what you want and that's what you want to achieve, then find out what you enjoy doing and find out what you're good at and do that, right? That I would use that as my yardstick. There's lots and lots of tactics and strategy that goes into optimizing your brand, et cetera, that's all very important. But ultimately, if you do things for tactical or strategic reasons, you're doing them for the wrong reasons.
Modification, because for example, one of the lessons of good entrepreneurship is be passionate about what you're doing. So starting a company where you don't have a passion for the subject, you're dead, right? The people who go, look, I'm going to do entrepreneurship because it's a way of making money, every startup goes through a valley of the shadow where you're like, why the hell was this a good idea? And LinkedIn, PayPal, all of them. So the passion part of it, I think, is extremely critical. The modification is that people frequently think that planning looks like, well, I'll discover my innate character of I have passion for this or I'm good at this. The way that entrepreneurs tackle problems, I think I want to go in this direction, and I do some quick planning and some quick information, and then I start heading in that direction. Like, don't think of it as I sit in a room and I meditate, and a year my answer comes to me. Go out and be in the field. Discover the answer. Discover your passion, your skills, and what you're good at, which I agree with. But do it by acting, yeah. Right? Have a predisposition to go forward.
Well, I'm sorry, just to chime in, I would entirely agree with that. I don't think this is a question of, you know, sitting down, you know, on the top of a mountain until you understand, you know, what nourishes your soul. I think that's fine for some people. For most people, it isn't. But I do think, though, and I think. Listening to myself, as I said, it sounds, well, that's pretty obvious. You know, you sort of do what you enjoy and then you'll be happy. But it's, in fact, it's not obvious in so many different ways, and there's so many different ways in which people go wrong, even in their daily lives. So, for example, it's a commonplace that if there's an aspect of your... let's say you're very, very good at communicating verbally, but you're much less good at some other skill. So what people tend to do is they tend to focus an awful lot of attention on improving the skill they're not good at. But again, there's lots of evidence, sort of happiness studies in the psychological literature, that's actually not the right, that is not the path to fulfillment. In fact, what you should be doing is focusing on those things that you are good at and get better at it, because you're much, much more likely to first of all, to succeed in the sort of modern world, but also to be happy. So I certainly agree that, life is no longer about master plans, if it ever was. I think one should certainly keep that in mind.
Let me give you a contrast, though, because so what I did is I came to Oxford thinking I was going to be an academic, decided not to be, decided I wanted to be an entrepreneur, went back to the Valley, and basically generated a list of what it was I would need, the assets I would need to achieve in order to get financing from a venture capitalist in order to create a software company. And I kind of did the research to figure out, well, normally VCs finance one business and one technical person as co-founders. They're looking for people, like on the business side, people who have P&L experience, people who have a wide range of product management, et cetera, et cetera. And then I went and got the only two times I went and got a job at Apple and Fujitsu in order to get the experiences on that list, in order to be able to go to VCs and say, I've got these experiences, now you can give me millions of dollars, I'm going to go start a company.
Yeah, but right. I did the same thing on that. My early businesses were kind of, it was me and people that I hired to like make things and do stuff. And I didn't even know what a management team was. It was basically, I did everything other than, some of the production. And I couldn't figure out, where is this going? This isn't happening. What do I need? I didn't know. And I got really interested in, it was kind of pre-web, at the time, interactive television was the thing. And I got really stoked on that. And I was in the East Coast of the U.S. I knew it was all happening in San Francisco. I said, okay, I got to get out there. I've got to figure something out. I've got to have experience. I've got to have exposure to that. And then, much like Reed said, I figured out a way to do that and took a job at an internet company and got that experience that I was after, and it was a good move. Not all the moves are good, and I think there's another point with the planning and strategy and all of that. As your career proceeds, the risks are higher. You have children, your family, the whole bit. In a way, there's a little more sense of entrapment or a sense of risk. Early in your career, go for it. Let it fly. You don't know. You fundamentally don't know what you're good at yet. You have some ideas from, you get a good scores in this or that. You have some, your friends, and you have some idea, but you don't necessarily know in a work context what you're really good at. So I love the idea of focusing on what you know you're good at and expanding that, but maybe there are opportunities for other things that you don't know about yet.
I'd like to change the framework a little bit and use a different pronoun. I'd like to change the pronoun from I to we, because most of you, the vast majority of you, are going to be in collaborative work. And by being in collaborative work, that means that one of the skill sets that's going to be most essential for your own happiness, fulfillment, and success is your ability to collaborate very, very well with people who have different expertise, who are from different countries, different cultures, different genders, every which way different than you, and being able to work collaboratively. Most of the people who get fired from jobs, it's because not that they didn't have the technical expertise, is that they had a failure in collaboration in some way, in terms of their communication skills, their decision making, their listening, whatever the skill sets are that contribute towards people not being able to work well in teams. Since most of you are going to work in ideas and with people, the stuff that you are working to create value, which is ultimately what's going to make you wealthier, is going to be your ability to work well in creating intellectual property with other people, whether you're employed by somebody else to do that or whether you're self-employed to do that. It almost doesn't matter. You're going to work in collaboration. I can't think of anything that I've done in my career that had any consequence that I didn't do in collaboration with someone else. And I've done a lot of individual activities, but ultimately the value added was working with others. So I think the focus on the I is somewhat misplaced. Obviously, we all have to be focusing on our own skill sets, and you need an expertise, but you must focus on your ability to work very, very well in teams. And there's some field now called value networks, which are looking at the way we create value for intangibles, which are not the same as deliverables that are tangible, in which value is truly created. We could talk about that later.
Yeah, that's very interesting. We've got about 25 minutes, so maybe we'll start drawing some questions from the audience at this point. Or if not, I've got a question. I thought I was in a room full of bright people. Did you guys have... Yes, okay, at last.
I do have a bit of a question about intangibles. Since it is intangible, sometimes it's very hard to describe. Say, I want to tell an employer or somebody I'm working with on my competencies or these skills, but these are all intangibles. How should I communicate this?
I was wondering, in a job interview or when you're actually...
So can I just repeat
job?
The question for the benefit of the camera? So this is about how to try and portray your skill sets in the intangible areas?
Yes, intangible areas.
Okay. Jeff, could I ask you
sure.
to start for that?
Sure. When you are in a... I'm sure with Google or any of these companies, the actual technical ability is presumed. It's, are you optimistic? How have you solved some problems? Where are the situations where you came up against interpersonal difficulties? How did you handle them? Well, that's an intangible. Your ability to show how you've been able to, and when we look at intangibles, it's the process of how people work together. Have you been able to show that you have both a sophistication and a mastery of that as it relates to productivity? Just being liked is not sufficient. You must be able to be productive. And if you're going to be productive working with other people, then show situations where your ability to either lead or listen or conflict resolve made the difference. And those are characteristics that people highly value, because we work in situations now in which it's chaos with patterns. We're no longer in efficiency curves, and a lot of things you've learned in your management courses may no longer apply in terms of what the real world of work is, because we're dealing not with the experience curve the way traditional business was. Therefore, interpersonal skills becomes greater. So the answer to your question is, what have you done in those areas that show that you understand process and collaboration?
And I think in the interview process, for example, one of the things you can do is provide, you know, let me just tell you about this experience when it wasn't provoked, because sometimes, you know, interviews, people are checking the stats or going through their form, but you can offer an example of something that you've done, and just by offering that, you've already elevated your likelihood of being an impact player, of someone who actually makes things happen, because you have something to tell about what you're doing, and you're, even though you're not being asked, you're providing it. And so you're helping to build the communication with this person that needs to be done in order to move things along. And I think in general, I mean, one of the things every interview I always say is, this person in front of me a make it happen person? Is this person actually going to be able to work with other people and figure out how to get from point A to point B, regardless of the challenges in the way, and just go do it? And if it's someone who's going to stand back and wait for orders, that's a tough one.
Could I ask a follow-up question there?
Okay, quick one.
Yeah. So the problem is how to convince them, folks, because if I am on a team and the team does well, it does not necessarily mean that I was the one making it happen or contributing to it. So how do I go on convincing somebody that it's I made a difference in this team, so it did well?
Can I take that? And sorry, I think I'm going to disagree with Bob. Maybe this is this is why we have panels, right? I think that
Could you repeat the question?
So the question was about how you go about persuading people that you contributed to something which might which might be a team effort, for example. If you so I'm talking about it in the context of a job interview, which obviously presumably is top of mind for many people in this room. I don't believe that one should push that sort of information to an interviewer. I guess more generally, one shouldn't do the interviewer's job for them. If you're being interviewed by a decent company and people who know what they're doing, they will find ways of assessing your own ability and your own expertise and your own experience. I actually, personally, of course, everyone has different styles. This is part of the skill of being a candidate, is to actually discern, what kind of interviewer you're dealing with. But personally, it puts me off when people try and shove information down my throat. I tend to read that as indicative of someone who's sort of all over the place. But that's just me, and I appreciate, people have different styles.
Is that the distinction between an English culture and a US
culture?
Well,
I'm South African, so...
So you're mixed up.
So I can't comment on that.
I mean, there may be a cultural thing. I do think, in media training, you have this thing called bridging, which is, sure, you had a question here, and you want to make this point, and making sure that you put the foot forward about what someone should be understanding about you should be a way of doing it. Now, there's crass ways of doing it, right? And there is graceful ways of doing it. And one of the things that I think is absolutely right about what Peter said is that work is collaborative.
Jeff, sorry, excuse me.
It's been a long couple weeks. and part of what you're looking at is forming teams. Now, in entrepreneurial early stage companies, there's not very much bandwidth. A person has to be very much make it happen. As you scale, you still have a predisposition, action, and productivity, but it's will the person form part of a team well is important. And so, for example, the kind of things that I do a lot of reference checkings. I'm a huge believer in reference checking as well, and I kind of enforce that in the companies that I'm part of. But the kind of thing I'm looking for in a discussion is, does a person learn? Do they collaborate? Like, I push hard on an idea to see if they can... They actually engage with it, and they work as this is what a person would be like collaborating, and that kind of thing. Because basically, a hire is making a decision that's very close to what an investor is doing, which is, am I going to invest in this person in this slot in the company? And will I think that I will benefit from that? Like, I'll pay them a salary, and then the company will be better off. Now, some of that is the work they do and the skills they have. Some of that is, well, do they gel well with the team, and is the team going to be good and productive as a function of doing that? But the capacity for really getting work done. Now, the question, just to reflect, that you guys should all be thinking about and either asking us about or whatever is, how do you get a competitive edge personally? Why are you an attractive person to hire and so forth? And how do you establish that? And because the mistake usually, and the reason I usually give the advice of approaches as an entrepreneur is, everyone goes, McKinsey or Anderson has a hiring process, and I'm going to kind of run through the channel of that. Well, running through a channel where everyone else, that's what entrepreneurs do. They try to find an area where there's the place where I have a competitive edge. People haven't realized this market yet, that kind of stuff. How do you do that personally is a really central question. And that's one of the things that if you're not thinking about, you should be. Now, it may just happen to be I'm going to win the McKinsey interviews, 100 or 200 people, and I'll be one of the three people, and that can work. But actually, there's a reason why, as an entrepreneur, one of the things that I... or an investor, one of the things that I do is I have never invested in a company founded by a management consultant, because the go off and do it and build the thing and find that kind of the market edge and niche is one of the things that is central to doing entrepreneurship well. So that's the kind of thing to think about. And if I'm prompting you to ask those questions, that's the kind of thing to start asking questions about.
Reed, we have three questions building up in the meantime.
Okay, great.
So let's start over there. We'll keep the questions short and the answers even shorter.
We'll try.
Okay.
My name is Chris Ryan from the Judge Business School. And so, given your experience of entrepreneurship, what if you were to run the Judge Business School, what courses might you put in place such that it gives the students the right skill sets to be successful?
I didn't even pay for that.
Excellent question.
Ted, you haven't spoken yet, so I'll give you a
Oh, golly, give me the hard one.
You take the hard one.
No, as someone who starts business schools. And, no, I mean, I worry a lot about business school, actually, as a thing for young people to go and do. And when people come and ask me, you know, should I go to business school, I look at the person and say, I'm not entirely sure you should go to business school, because I think, you know, because I agree with this sort of underlying point in your question, which is perhaps the wrong classes are being taught right now. I don't know if that's true. But what I would say is that I think there is an enormous opportunity to do, and you can have a class in an environment like a Judge Business School where you're giving the students the opportunity to do. And reflecting on the education that my children are getting right now, one of the things that they were asked to do in middle school was start a business. So as young people at 12 and 14 year olds, they have to come up with a business plan. They have to pitch that business plan to a group of venture capitalists, entrepreneurs, and get funded. They then actually have to bring a product to market and sell it to their peers. I don't know if you do these things here, but I think there's an enormous amount that can be learned by that. I think bringing people in from the outside to also share those real-world experiences is essential. The challenge of having people that are professors being the only people you interact with is they get further and further away from the world. The world is changing really rapidly, and the kinds of things that you believe should be done because of your experience may be entirely wrong if you're too far from what's happening in the market right now.
Jeff, because you're an educator.
Well, since I teach at a business school and I've taught in MBA programs for about 15 years, and my son went to Wharton and I saw what he got at Wharton and as well as Stanford, it is underestimated the importance of the collegial relationships that are built with your fellow students during the period where you're doing case studies, and presumably case studies enable you to not only learn and integrate the information, but to the dynamic among yourselves creates that collaborative spirit or not, and that leadership evolves among your peers, and that you folks are going to be your networks, your Facebooks, for the rest of your professional lives is critically important. So if you're going into a business school and you have the attitude, I'm only here to take in information and give the information back, total waste of time. If you're coming in and saying, I'm learning one skill sets, and I'm learning them with a group of people that will be my peers and colleagues, and I'm getting the opportunity in a training wheels environment to actually execute collaborative enterprises and to be able to work with conceptual frameworks and being understanding what's important to learn and what can you leave. You don't have to read everything. What's important to read, what's important to be a leader or be a follower in a group. That's critically important. And graduate school, by the way, unlike any of the businesses that we're all in, is supposed to nurture you. None of these guys are nurturing the people that they work with as the reason why they hired them. You're in a situation where you, if you take that opportunity, are developing skill sets that other people are not going to pay for you to learn when you're in the job. They expect you to have them. So I think how you approach graduate school is critical. And so what would I want to see? I'd want to see more focus on collaborative skill development, on being cross-cultural communications and being able to work with people who are not the same as you, and being able to link to graduate students in other regions and other universities to do joint projects, because that's what you're going to do in real life.
I think we'd tick all those three boxes, Jeff, as it happens. We'll move on, but one of the distinctions is between education about entrepreneurship and education for entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. And I think the Judge has moved much closer to the for entrepreneurship than the about. Many business schools are still stuck in the about framework. But let's go to another question from the back there.
Yeah, I'm Mark from the engineering department, and I just want to say, having done my MBA at Stern, I agree with 100% what was just said about wanting to get out of business school. But my question is, the whole interview process is quite subjective, or the person, the interviewer, subjective, and I think that was demonstrated by the disagreement on the panel. And even the resume can be viewed subjectively as well. So what can somebody do to minimize that from becoming a factor in getting hired? Like, for instance, is there ways to minimize, like, the interviewer's perhaps preconceived perception that that person coming into the office before the person gets there to interview?
Thanks. Robert, would you like to repeat the question?
Given that there are a number of interviewing styles and interview, and the whole process is intrinsically a subjective one, are there ways in which you can minimize the sort of the risk associated with that? And I think the answer to that is if you are going to look for a job at a company, at a good company, whether that's large or small, because ultimately that bit's not really in your control. I mean, I think really you can, there's a limit to how tactical you can be about these things. You know, if you interview at Google, I mean, there's a lot that could be said about the interview process of Google, which I won't go into now, but you can rest assured that you will be meeting enough people, and you'll be meeting people of sufficient smarts and sort of sensitivity, that there's a pretty good chance that they'll come to a pretty sensible decision about you, regardless of what tactics you deploy.
Using Twitter, Facebook, blogging, LinkedIn, etc. But I do always wonder how you balance this building of a network with your own sense of personal privacy. I mean, in your own online lives, how do you balance those two things?
Yeah, this one's funny, especially having Reed here. I don't let my friends join my LinkedIn, and I don't let my business guys be on my Facebook. So I use both of those products, but I just make the distinction. And people who I don't know or I'm not friends with, I get a lot of those, I don't let them in. So some people just want to see a big number of contacts, and I'd rather have, you know, business over here and personal over here.
You know, I think it does depend on what stage of your career that you're at. Where I'm at in my career, I actually want people to know what my political views are. I want them to know about the fact that I have a personal life. I don't publish my personal home address, right? So there's things that I do try to protect. But actually, I think some of the traditional notions of privacy are really going to go away as we move forward. Too much of our lives are already going to be online, not only because we put them online, but because other people around us put them online. And so trying to defend our privacy, I think, will sort of become an anachronistic sort of notion. At the same time, I do think that when you're younger, that you need to be able to work fluidly with people, even if you have disparate views. And so sometimes you'll be inclined to try to suppress putting those views online. I think that inclination is not a bad one, but you need to recognize that the next day when your friend actually puts something up about you, that everybody else will know it anyway. So hopefully what this means by our all being more out in the open about what we do, because we put it there or other people put it out there, that we're all more tolerant of each other as well. And so the notion of privacy, that I need to be private about the fact that I'm a liberal Democrat so the Republicans will still work with me, hopefully the notion that they won't work with me because I'm a liberal Democrat will actually erode over time, because we'll all recognize we have different views and yet that diversity is valuable.
The only thing I would add, I completely agree with both comments. The thing I would add is to emphasize what Ted's saying. Basically, there will be brand image about you on the web, period. So the question is given that, what do you do in order to maximize the brand that you want to be out there? What happens when people Google you, et cetera? And my angle for that is, personally, is I put a lot of energy into having my professional brand out front and center, because that's what I want to have in the general public. And I'm, I wouldn't say restrictive, but actually relatively cautious about kind of more of the personal stuff. And for example, I wouldn't have published the picture of myself from the Cambridge Union debate with me in black tie, because it's not really what I am. But Blake, one of the other guys, already did it, and it's already on Facebook and tagged. And it is what it is, but who cares, right? So anyway.
Just before we take on to last questions.
I think we have till 11:15.
Sorry?
I think we have till 11:15.
Oh, you're right, actually. We have another 20 minutes. That's good. I Googled President Abdul Kalam, former President of India, and looked at his website, and then he had his profile on there. I clicked on that. There was a whole page about his mother, actually. And that told me more about the gentleman and where he came from than if he'd done all this kind of, I suppose that's kind of brand management, but I was very touched by that kind of profile.
Well, and the key to brand management today is that it's transparent and authentic and real. Because if you go out and you lie about yourself, you put up some fake story about how you came from poor family and had a mother, but actually you're from wealth, it will come out. Someone else will say, well, this is ridiculous.
Yeah. Completely agree again. One other little amplification. So again, so the strategy in the web is not to retract information, it's to put out the right information you want. There's going to be a bunch of information there. So, for example, you cannot have any kind of publicness as a figure and not have personal stuff out there. But so, for example, part of what I do is I talk a lot about this board game I really like, Settlers of Catan. Right, that becomes there's a newspaper article in the States being written on this right now, and that's fine, right? Because that allows me to kind of put that out there and be part of the kind of the brand management. And so that's what I would say is think about what you don't focus on the strategy of what you retract. Think about the strategy of what you publish.
Okay, a couple questions from there, and then one. Yeah.
How do you make yourself more marketable, in particular when changing careers?
So how would you make yourself more marketable if you're switching from an academic track to a business track? Right?
Well, so the high line is people are always taking, just like, again, same metaphor, entrepreneurship, people are taking a risk in hiring you, right? So what you're trying to do is make them believe that the risk decision they're taking has the right has the right characteristic. So one of the reasons, for example, and this, again, I look for, you know, kind of, collaborativeness, kind of work ethic. Usually you can get that more through reference checking. It's very difficult to pick that up in an interview. Everyone presents, oh, it's great work ethic, and, you know, it's kind of hard to figure out. ability to kind of solve problems and intelligence quickly and so forth. So the question is, when you're jumping far afield, like, and it's not just academic to work, but say, for example, you're moving from internet to clean tech or clean tech to internet, there's an additional risk element. Right, of like, okay, and so you have to, and that's why you look at what are your competitive edges. Can you network your way into the job and get a really strong reference? Can you present as really smart? Are you willing to take a job on kind of contingency, right? Like just kind of like the okay, like here I'll start at a low level or anything else, and it's all of that kind of competitive edge positioning for the person thinks the reward will be worth the sufficient. Additional risk.
Let me introduce a word that I think is going to be really important to all of us, us as well as to all of you who are starting your careers, and that word is adaptability. And I think one of the things that you will recognize through your careers is that the world is changing so fast that you're going to have 12, 15, 20 different careers. You're going to be making these switches. And I think one of the things to do when you're trying to make a switch, making yourself more marketable, is to demonstrate to the person that you're marketing yourself to that you've shown that adaptability characteristic in some other part of your life. So you say, I am an adaptable person. I can learn fast. I can jump in and change the way I think about things. Then they'll say, oh, well, maybe you'll be able to jump in and change your way of thinking about this.
And I think another thing on that, if you're in a new area, the incumbent competitors for the jobs might be easier to deal with. For example, in the solar energy field, we couldn't find any engineers who knew anything about solar energy. Zero. We could find people who knew about optics and thermal and electronics and, you know, all different things, but we couldn't find solar people because it was a new growing field at that time. And so if you had come from an academic field at that point and had some predisposition towards some activity that we were, you know, trying to deal with, you might be easier to break in that place.
As someone who spent the first 5 years of his career as a barrister, I can tell you it's not easy, and it is a real challenge. Something which I think can be very useful, it certainly worked for me. If you're thinking about entering the world of employment, your chances to diversify, I think, are much greater within a company, or rather to move, I should say, are much greater within a company than sort of applying for a job that, you know, n number of people are more obviously suited for, right? So, for example, in my case, you know, I it's a whole long story, but I basically joined the sort of startup as a co-founder, but as the kind of legal guy. And then over the course of the evolution of that company, I then moved into the role that I was looking to move into.
So, if I can build on what he just said, if you define the transition not as going from academia to the business world, which is an artificial distinction, rather one, there are people who know you versus people who don't know you. The ones who know you are more likely, know you in different contexts, are more likely to give you the benefit of the doubt if indeed they've been impressed by you. So one is building that relational capital, that long term you're never quite sure who is going to be a player in helping you to make any transition. And two, if you have a skill set, that skill set is utilized in different places. If you're a finance person, you can be a finance person in an NGO, and you can be a finance person in a company, and that finance ability and your ability to communicate that, yes, you're adaptable in finance in terms of showing how it's transferable, is going to be far more important than whether or not you were in academia or whether you were in business. So it's how you frame it, and it's not who you know, it's who knows you and what do they think about you.
Thank you for that.
So just the amplification in terms of the framework, and two seconds, and the question is people's knowledge of you reduces the risk, right? That's why that's useful in terms of the framework.
My question was actually going in a very similar direction. I mean, my understanding is that most MBAs are actually looking for career change. And especially in the current job market, companies are very particular about the profile of the candidate they're looking for. So if you start to look at these job ads and you see, okay, you have to be a chartered accountant, you have to have worked for a blue chip company before, you have to have experience in digital media, it's like a very particular what they want. I mean, if I don't fulfill these criteria, does it make, from your point of view, from your understanding, does it make sense to apply in the first case or will it just, I mean, it's going to HR, they are checking the boxes. If I don't check the boxes, do I have a way to get around these very, very specific, very particular requirements?
Does the conversation company check boxes?
No, we don't check boxes. Actually, you know, this doesn't work for everybody. And I don't know if it'll work for you, but obviously my own personal experience, I have never looked at a job listing. Every job I've had either because I created the company, because I said, I want to go do this, so I'm not going to let anyone stand in my way, I'm going to go do it, or because I saw something I wanted to go do, and I went and knocked on the door, or I used my personal number, even before there was a LinkedIn, you know, we have social and business networks, and I would say, how do I get an opportunity to do this with these people, right? So I saw... In 1988, I saw an article in Time magazine about how nanotechnology was going to change the world and how this group at the business school at Chicago was founding Illinois Superconductor. I said, I want to go work at that business school for that venture fund because I want to be part of that. And I just knocked on the door. I said, I'll take any job here. I don't care what it is. I'll work my ass off. I'll prove myself. I'll work myself up. I was the assistant to the secretary for the president of the venture fund. And pretty soon I was an associate running big projects. Because I went in and I proved myself. So I would say, rather than worrying about checkboxes, go and find the place you want to be, find where you can get in the door, and then go prove yourself.
Bob, you have competencies listed on your website under careers at Green Vaults.
Mm-hmm.
I don't. Did you craft those competencies, or is it a team thing?
You know, I did produce competencies. I don't know if they're the same ones. I haven't looked at it in a long time. But they're really, if you look at that, it's really around the make it happen kind of attitude.
Right.
The same thing that Ted's talking about. You know, Ted could have any job. You know, he would be great to have because he would say that story. And he would figure out how to tell me that story in an interview. That's really important. I think there's another aspect that of what Ted just said. And when we look at people, you know, in this problem with solar where we don't have a lot of engineers or people experienced in the field, we say, well, who are the people, what were they doing, say, 10 years ago? Or what was the happening thing where they said, I want to be here. I want to be in this. What was that back then? Because those same people who dove in to that thing back then are probably the same people with perhaps that experience. And I'll give you a practical one. We needed a really strong optical designer, and we couldn't find the right thing. We said, well, who is really jumping in to build something new? It was actually, you know, 10 years ago, these things were fairly new. And so they have a lot of the complexity of motors and heat and optics. And so we said, okay, there's someone who got involved in display projectors are, that might be the right place to go. And that's so we started looking for someone who had chosen that industry at that time for that problem as being someone who was likely to be successful at the next thing, which is what we would, you know, think we're doing.
If I can build on what Ted said, because it's critical, almost every business school that I've, particularly in Europe, people think that they want to be work for consulting firms, or they want to be in brand management as the preferred profession, and that's what they go after. Very few jobs are in those areas. Almost nobody says that they want to work in sales or they want to work in IT support. So what I would, and those are areas that there are a great number of jobs and opportunities, and by the way, those people who do a good job are highly respected within those companies, and there's a lot of lateral movement. So one, pick the industry and the company first, not the job type first. When you're looking, because if it's a great company in which there's a lot of lateral movement and it's a nurturing environment in which people are valued, it doesn't matter what you start in because you are starting. And sales, I'll give you one example. I just wrote a chapter on sales training on Genentech. Genentech has about 20 people in marketing. They have 1,800 salespeople. Those salespeople are highly sophisticated pharmacists who are calling on very highly sophisticated buyers. Those salespeople are going to be the ones that are going to be running units in Genentech, not the marketing people, their staff. Salespeople are close to the customer. That skill set of being close to the customer is critical in a place like the biotech pharma industry. But when you are looking at what do you want to be, most of you would probably not say, gee, I'd want to apply to Genentech in sales. I'd rather apply to Bain Consulting and be a consultant because that's what I'm doing when I do my case studies. So the experience that you have here is irrelevant in terms of the kind of job that you should be looking for in terms of function. Because recognize, whatever function you're going to go into 6 months or a year later, you're going to be doing something completely different within that company.
Jeff, that's really good advice, because around Cambridge, if you talk to the capitalists, business angels, the CEOs of local companies, the one skill set that's missing is sales. And they're really looking to the Dutch Business School alumni community, the MBAs, to say, train these guys up. So your question about what should we be teaching you, we talk to the business community here, just teach them sales.
Well, you know, let me just jump in, because I had the opportunity to meet the Baroness Janet Cohen 2 days ago, and she said, oh, well, you're going up to judge and talking to students. Could you please tell them two things? We desperately need sales, and we desperately need finance people. That's what the business community around Cambridge is lacking. So.
And if you could manage both, that would be great. There's a question from the back. So what sort of jobs can you apply for if you have a PhD in finance?
Yeah, if you have a technology background.
So I think the Baroness would love to meet you and help you get into one of her companies. Now, I don't know specifically what the curriculum is for a PhD in finance, but clearly you're quite familiar with all of the issues related to balance sheets and funding issues. And every startup has a set of issues where the entrepreneurs in a place like Cambridge are scientists. They don't understand how to actually make a financial report to a board of directors that actually makes sense. They don't know how to do projections. They don't know how to think about what their financing requirements are over the next, you know, in some cases, life sciences company, 5-7 years. You know, I was talking to one of my neighbors the other day who's the finance director for a biotech company in the United States. His job next year is to raise $50 million for his company. Right. Well, there's an enormous amount of thinking around finance and around how you structure these things that has to be done. I'm sure you could be enormously helpful. You go in and say, look, it depends on the size of the company, right? If you want to start in a small company, you could be the finance director, be the controller, be the person who's also providing the strategy around the future of the financing. You could be doing everything and stretching yourself. Or find an organization that's already started and say, I just want to be the number two. I want to do all of the scout work because I want to learn.
Okay, so I want to come back to that. There's a question coming from the back there. To find the company you want to work for?
Well, I want to answer that question and also comment further there. If you're a finance person studying finance, what are the biggest opportunities for a finance type person? And what are the trends? What are the companies that are moving things ahead? Connecting those dots kind of answers that. But in the case of finance, I think if I were in business school right now, that's exactly where I would be. Maybe it's because I'm not so strong there. But secondly, what I see in my business is as the global infrastructure around energy is, we know it's coming. We know we have to figure out how to get this financed. And we don't really know as humanity how to do it. And the size of the capital flows are not $50 million. They're hundreds of billions or trillions of dollars. And we have to figure out how to do fairly complex transactions around multiple private, public, international entities where you have bonds and all kind of complex projects. And how do you ascertain the yields from those projects, and how do you tie all that together? How do you map it out and analyze and understand that? You need a PhD in finance or a bunch of them to figure that out. And so there's a great demand in that area.
As we're beginning to run out of time, there is one question I did want to ask, which might be relevant for the audience as well, which is, did any of you guys have a mentor to advise you on your careers and how you progress? And do you yourselves act as mentors to young people, either in your company or outside? And should we be advising the group here to go find a mentor?
I absolutely.
I would actually state it differently. I wouldn't go find a mentor. I would look to as many people as possible to be mentors, plural. I do mentor people all the time. I feel that's one of my professional responsibilities to give back to the community that has supported me. And in my career, I've always looked for people who I respect, who I can go to, who I can ask questions to. And if you do so in a respectful and interesting way, people generally will give you the help.
Can you throw some light on it, like an aha moment that the mentor gave you, that determined a direction for you?
I'll reflect on, I mentioned Arch Development Corporation, which was the venture fund that I went to initially to help start because I was excited about superconductors and nanotechnology. And my mentor there was a fellow named Thomas Churchwell, who now continues to run it 25 years later. And he looked at me and said, I don't understand why, I understand you're so passionate about superconductors and nanotechnology because it's exciting, but you don't have any expertise there. You have enormous expertise in computers. Why aren't you focusing on computers? And furthermore, why aren't you actually doing a startup rather than helping us just fund startups? And so, it wasn't an aha as much as it was a push. It was somebody actually saying, "Let me help." You're already going in a direction. I already see you have interest. Let me just push you a little bit to encourage you. And I think encouragement may be more important than the aha.
Well, I think this also answers your question. If you're looking at trade shows are a great way to. If you go to a trade show in an industry and you are excited by what you see in terms of certain companies, and I don't just mean their booths, I mean what they're doing, it's a great way to get some insight. And there are reports on the best 100 companies to work for in this industry or that, but that's a secondary thing. If you're in a company that looks at mentorship seriously as part of their management structure, that's a good place to work. If you're working in a company, particularly at an entry level, that has no responsibility for you and is only looking to exploit you, and there are a lot of places where there are a lot of assholes who are running units in which their ability to manage people is irrelevant, it's strictly a metric, and they couldn't care less about you, that's a bad place for you to work because it can destroy your confidence. And that's the most important thing you need, all of you right now, is the confidence to make that transition from school to work in terms of feeling that you're productive, you're useful, etc. The mentoring can come in many forms. If you have a boss that has high standards and holds as fair and tough, that's a great mentor because that will set a bar for you for the rest of your life. I was fortunate to have that. It didn't matter that I didn't stay in that industry. That bar was held for the rest of my life with that superego of that boss who was that way. The other is that there are going to be people who are going to take an interest in you, or you may have problems, and those people who may either be in the industry or may be outside of it may be very, very good mentors, and we're talking about plural, not a mentor, many mentors, because your ability to be able to utilize skill sets from others is a critical, critical skill set that you have to develop. It's your ability to recognize somebody that can help you and be able to solicit that advice and be taken seriously is going to be one of the most important skill sets you're going to have.
Thanks.
So that mentoring goes both ways. You have to be a good mentee as
amazing.
Well as a mentor.
Let me get a couple of voices in that haven't talked about mentoring yet and read and
well,
Robert.
Look, mentoring's critical. It's great. I mentor lots of people. But, you know, I wish I'd had a mentor who gave me the following advice, right, from day one. In the end, I did it, but it took a long time, and most of the people in my industry, I go back to my old chambers, they're still miserable. And that advice is follow your heart, right? Follow your heart. It's, you know, all the tactics and strategy in the world, it's not going to make you happy, right, unless you follow your heart. Now, often it's hard to figure out where that's going to take you. You might have a million and one things in mind, but be true to yourself. You know, I was lucky enough that, you know, having done all the tactical stuff and having had this career at the bar, I kind of one day, I said, right, I'm never going to spend a second again doing something that I don't want to do. And I made that call. But I wish I'd had someone to actually push me to do that 5 years previously.
I completely agree with all the comments that it's leverage your network, right? Multiple mentors. And mentors is not just, oh, look, there's this person on a pedestal. Frequently when I'm asked the question this myself, I have like multiple lists, like, oh, this person's really smart about technology, this person's really smart about management, this person's really smart about financing. And those, I use the network of intelligence in order to get back things that are helpful to me. And
but Reed, that's very transactional rather than a mentor. Mentor is concerned about your happiness, if you like, as opposed to transaction-oriented about drawing resources.
In that,
is there a subtle difference between the two?
Yes, although, for example, all the people that are in my network are people I collaborate with. Right, so all relationships are two-way streets. So, for example, a question about how to be a good mentee is that as well, right? And so, what I do is like there are people I call when I think, oh, I'm trying to solve this kind of problem. There are people I call. They call me on certain things too, right? That's the way that works. And I think the really critical thing is to realize that it's a two-way street, right? So, for example, I have a group of people I mentor as well. But the people that I mentor are people that essentially kind of I look at as part of my tribe. I have a 20-year relationship with.
Okay. Listen, guys, we're running out of time. Ted's got to go somewhere. We've got 10 minutes to get to the next rooms. Let's thank the panel.